Labdien, esiet sveicināti raidījumā Brīvības būvārs. Tikko kā latviski izdota somu filozofa Kaja Alhinena grāmata par dialogu, kurā teikts, ka tieši šobrīd cilvēcei vairāk nekā jau kad agrāk ir vajadzīga prasme vienam otrā klausīties. Tas ir kļuvis par izdzīvošanas jautājumu gan individa, gan kopienas, gan visas cilvēces līmenī. Filozofs un politikas zinātnieks Kaja Alhinens šodien ir arī mūsu studijā. Hi!
Hello!
We live in times when it's not clear what to do, for example, with diplomacy. How far can negotiated settlements go? Even in these negotiations, such as Trump with President Zelensky of Ukraine in the White House, which was we seen 1 month ago, it was we have seen as a, I would say, the biggest breaks, the conversation. And we could say that interstate politics is often driven by recognition of power these days, and who is the strongest and most influential, and the communication that follows from that. You are, however, expressing ideas that conversation, dialogue can save us. How in this kind of circumstances, what we see now in the current politics?
Well, I think first it's important to understand what we mean when we talk about dialogue. What is the concept of dialogue? And for me, and the concept that I'm using in this book, and which has a long history, is that dialogue is a conversation aiming at better understanding. Better understanding of the topic that we're talking about, of other people, but also aiming at better understanding about ourselves. And I think in that sort of sense, dialogue is different from other forms of conversation like debating, where you want to know who has the best arguments, who's right, who's wrong, and negotiating, where you are trying to make agreements, you are trying to find solutions, you are making compromises. So how dialogue then plays into this field of different styles of communication, I think that in order for us, because I think we need all of them, we need debating and we obviously need negotiating also. But in order for us to make good agreements, find good solutions, make good compromises, we need to understand each other. So before we start to have negotiations, and even before we start debating, we should try to make sure that we have had enough of dialogue beforehand, so we understand actually what we're trying to talk about. I think in this moment in our world, not just with the conflicts, but with all the different crises that we are having at the moment, we are not putting enough of effort in dialogue. We are not yet having dialogues where we would just first focus on truly trying to understand what's going on and how different people, different groups of people see the situations. And without that, I think we end up having lots of difficulties, we end up having lots of misunderstandings, and we end up having lots of conflicts and many difficulties of trying to find the solutions if we are lacking in these efforts of understanding first.
But you've wrote in your books that current crisis, and you also said that largely to the facts that certain groups of people have acted cruelly for decades, even centuries, and do not count with the suffering of others. And this tendency has created complex, devastating problems that cannot be solved by individuals or groups. And when we're thinking about the war in Ukraine and in Europe, what kind of dialogue do you think is possible during the war and after the war?
Well, this is a very good question, and I think we need to be very careful here because there is a tendency also of misusing the idea of dialogue. We can notice from, for example, on Russia's side, in many occasions that they are saying that the problem is that we are lacking dialogue, that there should be more dialogue between them and the West, or the West is failing in the dialogue. And honestly, we also know that they are not genuine. They are not genuine in this messaging. It's a way of manipulating. It's like a way of saying that we know that dialogue is somehow important to you. So we can use this as a kind of a way to distract or confuse what is actually happening here. So in order to make dialogue happen, people need to be willing to do that. And that is a big challenge, obviously. I don't think you can have a true dialogue with partners who don't really want to be in a dialogue. So something needs to happen before the willingness to enter into a dialogue can happen. And I think our previous president, Martti Ahtisaari, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, made lots of dialogues in different conflict areas. And he always said that don't come to the table before, something like that, that don't come to the table if you're still willing to kill each other. You know, you need to start from the moment where you want to have other kind of solutions. Then the dialogue can start to happen. So I think we need to be careful in too naive about the possibilities of dialogue in a situation like this. But I don't think
it means that when we're talking about this so-called Putin-Trump's peace talks, it's nothing to do with a dialogue in this focus or context, but about you.
No, I don't think it has anything to do with dialogue at the moment. I think it's a deal-making process, and it doesn't include deeply the partners that should be there around the table to discuss and build the common understanding what's happening. So I think that's the problem. And to call that what is happening a dialogue, I think that just creates more confusion and more distraction. We should be very direct about what is happening. But I want to add also that I don't think the power of dialogue and why we need it so much at the moment, it's not only that those people who are the different sides of the conflict should be able to have some sort of dialogue. I think we also need dialogue amongst ourselves. Because I don't think even in democratic societies, we don't have enough of dialogue inside our societies. So we are losing some of our crucial possibilities of being creative and understanding what's going on and building our strategies, how to deal, how to navigate in this difficult world at the moment. So it's not only that we need dialogue in the conflict situations, we also need dialogues on all levels of the society, how to deal in these troubled times.
But no, people, as many researchers saying that it's not a time about dialogue, it's sort of a methodology of how to conversate about values, probably. Many researchers said this is a time for realpolitik. It's a different kind of negotiations, probably, where dialogue has nothing to do. We just react to what is happening. And
well, I mean, whatever the situation is, I assume that we would like to find the best possible solutions. In order to act in this realpolitik situation, we probably would like to act wisely, cleverly, in a creative way. And in order for that to happen, we need to understand what's going on. We need to understand how even our closest people, our closest allies or partners, people that we work with, how do they see the situation? How can we get the most out of their individual unique perspectives to the situation? So no matter what's going on, I think in order for us to survive, we need dialogue. I started the book by saying that I think dialogue is a survival skill for humanity.
But you say dialogue towards ourselves.
Yeah, among ourselves. Yeah. Among ourselves. Like, I mean, I work also very on a practical level quite a lot. I work a lot with work communities, for example, different kind of work communities. I'm mostly with the public sector, but also in the private sector. And in all places, we need dialogue in order to understand the situation. You know, what's going on now? What is happening in our workplace, in our organization, in our country, in our government? What are the issues that we're dealing with? Do we understand them well enough? We need dialogue also to understand each other. Even though we would be working in the same workplace, I think most of us know how much misunderstandings can happen and what can they cause. And then in order also to clarify our own thinking, our own perspective. That's also why we need dialogue. It's very difficult to get a clear idea of what you actually are thinking or how you are feeling about certain situation if you don't interact with other people. So in that sort of sense, for me, the whole question of dialogue is like a big societal question. And no matter what we are doing and how difficult it is, we need to create spaces and moments where we just focus on learning and understanding.
Another thing to bear in mind is, for example, when we're talking about national security and defense interests of 27 EU member states, which are far from harmonized, I would say, in the EU. And when Orbán sympathizes with Putin and Fico promises to go to Moscow May 9th, what should we do? What kind of dialogue with both as possible.
I think what is interesting at the moment and promising inside Europe is that we are now talking about this, we're using the phrase of coalition of the willing. So we are recognizing that we are lacking with common interest with some countries. But there is a big majority inside of the European Union who seem to have quite common interests. So now this coalition, who kind of recognize each other, that okay, we are the ones who are sharing certain values, certain interests, we need to come together. And it's not automatic that these countries or the people who represent them understand each other. And how do they start to clarify and plan how to navigate in this situation, how to act in a situation where within a union there are one country or two or three countries who are constantly choosing other ways to deal with issues based on other values. So I think we, again, where is the dialogue here? I think the most important dialogue should happen within the coalition of the willing. Because if they don't put lots of effort in understanding each other and understanding the situation very clearly, they don't find the best strategies in this moment. So again, I think the dialogue needs to be happening in many different levels. And also within those people who seem to be agreeing, they need dialogues in order to be really creative.
But in countries like Finland or in the Baltics, which are geographically closer to Russia, and have experienced Russian occupation, perceives the threat more correctly. How do you think we should communicate our expertise in a way that influence European policy? This historical argument is also argument for this dialogue or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't have the direct answer to that. I'm not an expert in kind of a security and foreign policy as such, but I think what is very promising at the moment is that we are finding each other in a different way. I think that we should definitely create venues where we, like these borderland countries, as you might call them, like Finland, the Baltic countries, and Poland, for example, we could sit down, try to understand first each other, these different perspectives, because I think things look a bit different from Finland than they look from the Baltic countries and then compared to Poland, for example. So we could learn quite a lot from each other. And I think by doing that, having that kind of dialogue first, I think we could find a common approach, how we can then talk to the other European countries. Because at the moment, I think it's the challenge is that our experiences don't resonate that well yet with other countries. But I think we would be stronger together. But in order to do that, we need to find the common ways to do that. And that requires dialogue. But I think this is happening now more and more. We are seeing these new kind of coalitions emerging also inside of Europe, where we find each other in a new way. And I think one of those is that these countries that share the border with Russia at the moment, we are sharing something that kind of sets us a little bit apart from other countries. And we are also sharing a very interesting and complicated history with Russia, but different histories. And bringing those experiences together in a dialogue, that could be our strength at this moment.
Before our interview, took a look at NATO's Strategic Communication Center research about Baltics and Nordic countries and Finland. And there was mentioning that Putin positions spelled out in 2016 that things would change if Finland joined NATO and that Russian troops would no longer stay 1,500 kilometers back from the Finnish border. The biggest change to Russia influence strategy targeting Finland came with Finland joining NATO. How do you see this manifesting that Russia special information operations, how they are influencing and polarizing society in Finland after Putin promised that that his position will change in 2016? That happened or not?
Of course, there have been these like hybrid attacks towards Finnish institutions, but I genuinely think that we were surprised how weak Russia actually was in their capability to really try to influence Finland before and after the decision to join NATO. So I am quite satisfied. I think we have a good resilience in Finland against this kind of aims of influencing especially influencing the population through some kind of a disinformation, misinformation campaigns or those sort of things. What I'm actually more concerned now is how we manage with the United States and their turn towards authoritarianism, because we have not built our kind of a societal and kind of a mental defenses against the West. We have, you know, used lots of effort to build it against the authoritarianism in East. So now this is a tricky situation. And I think, again, we should come together with other countries to talk about this and have the dialogues where we create the understanding first. What is the situation? How do different countries see it? Because it's different in different countries. And then, based on that better understanding, create new strategies, common strategies. I'm not so much in Finland and other places asked about this kind of a more kind of bigger geographical political question. So it was very good to talk about it, because I've obviously been thinking about it quite a lot.
Because, no, I would say, honestly, when we say... Because we are a very polarized society, and I would say somebody is coming to us and say we need a dialogue, because word dialogue is very used, we need really reshape the meaning of, we could go back to Plato or Socrates and say, you know, idea come from ancient culture or something like that, but when somebody says that we need dialogues, it's everybody will say, come on. What kind of dialogue is possible with a murderer?
And I think that's always the big problem, is very often that people tend to go to the extremes immediately and don't necessarily realize that
maybe we are living in black and white.
And then the gray area disappears, and the gray area is where the changes can actually happen. And because then you, instead of just thinking of Putin first, we should think about what's happening in our schools or you know, in our workplaces. Because those are the places where we can actually have influence also. Of course, we need to keep in mind what's happening with Russia, but it can't take all the, you know, the airspace of the discussion about dialogue.
But there is no difference like in mindset of society after joining NATO and before.
In Finland?
Yes.
I think there is. I think there's a huge change of mindset, but I think it was, I mean, the most important thing that happened, and I can really, really remember it, was that the first time the Finnish political leaders, our president, our prime minister, talked honestly about Russia after the attack.
Yeah.
And that liberation, you know, it was because in Finland we were carrying this, you know, we were lucky that we were not occupied, but we were compromised. And in the public discussion on the top level of the society, they could never say honestly what they thought about Russia. And then when they said that, I think it changed so much in the Finnish society, at least in my experience, that suddenly we were able to kind of talk about everything in that sort of sense, also about Russia. And that changed. And I think that also made us more courageous. And now with this militarization talk, we are constantly like, well, we have done our job, you know. So in that sort of sense, it's kind of a, like, we are part of the NATO. I think most Finns are still very happy that we are part of the NATO, because it feels good to be in a family, you know, where you can believe, at least, well, we are not sure about the United States anymore, but we kind of think that, you know, Europe, at least the Nordic Baltics will stay together, whatever happens. Mm-hmm. We have so much in common. And it's good to be, you know, with that group. And also, it has also kind of give this vindication, which I think it's same here, even though I think Latvian and Estonian and Lithuanian people were more smarter than us, you were more aware of the real threat. I mean, we were not completely unaware, but we kind of we thought that you were too aggressive with your talk about Russia, but you were right, we were wrong. But now we have realized that, okay, we have also made good decisions in the past by keeping up the army quite strong, having the conscription. And at the same time, as I tried to say, we haven't sacrificed our democracy for the military. Yeah. Because that can happen. We know it from history that when this kind of a military values start to take over, democracy will be in danger. This is actually a topic of a conference that I'm arranging in Helsinki next at the beginning of June about war and democracy, because I think we should try to talk about these now together and what are the challenges and how can we manage the situation. Because I agree that we need the militarization, we need to build up the armies and defense, but we need to acknowledge that that can also endanger our democratic values. because authoritarianism and militarism go quite well together.
But also the problem with us is like wars could not change the situation. We could call Putin like a butcher or crime from ever political level, from your nation's stage, whatever. It's changed nothing.
No. That is the great failure of these institutions, I think. That is and I think that obviously the big problem is that you're in Europe, we thought that, you know, not we, but but European countries in general thought that, you know, we don't need force anymore. We don't need defense, like hard defense anymore, because we can solve it through our institutions. And we didn't realize that these guys are not playing our game. They're actually using our game to corrupt us. And I think that's the price we are now paying. And then to build up your military and defense capabilities after you have let them to fall down, it takes lots of time and it's much, much more expensive than if you would have acknowledged that this needs to be done all the time. And I think that's where Finns are quite satisfied at the moment with our defense situation, that we have, you know, there's not, you know, we don't need to, we are putting more resources in the military, but we don't, I mean, Sweden, compared to Sweden, they're in very bad situation because they need to build up quite a lot in a short time. And that's difficult and expensive. So in that sort of sense, I think joining NATO has kind of reaffirmed that, you know, we did make some good choices in the past.
Yeah. But do you think will European democracy change in the near future? And in what way when we have this situation with about you just said?
Well, I think it has to change, because if it won't change, I don't think it will survive in a longer run. And I think what we are seeing now, not just in United States, but also in many European countries, we are seeing how this form of liberal democracy is failing in many ways. It has difficulties of protecting citizens' privacy, protecting their rights, protecting their well-being. And also it has, I think, difficulties to dealing with the pressures coming from East and West now. So I think the democracies need to change. They need to evolve. And I think European democracies can evolve. But I think it will require a big crisis. And I think we are in that crisis now. So, and I think for me, I think the basic thing is that we need to make the democracies much more resilient, and the resilience needs to come from the citizens. We just can't think that the institutions will take care of everything. We need to engage the whole society in a different way and strengthen the civil society and individual citizens' capabilities to act in this moment and deal with this moment. So I think they have to change. What is the direction? Well, I hope the direction would be that we could create democracies that would be more inclusive and would give more power to citizens also on a local level. Because I think one of the biggest problems at the moment though is that people don't really see how democracy could work for them and could make their lives better.
You mean in local level or regionally?
Well, I mean, in lots of different ways. I think in general, we are now in a moment where we just, I mean, in a situation where we think that these institutions that we have created now will take care of all the things that, you know, the country needs from a political point of view. At the same time, we are seeing that so many people are losing their faith in democracy and turning towards authoritarian and populistic movements. So this is something we need to tackle, and that's an internal problem. Of course, it is used by Russia and China and now the United States to create chaos in our societies. But basically, it is something that we have also created by alienating this group of people. So, and I think what we need to do is that we somehow need to engage the population on a different level in to be part of democracy, really feel what democracy means. And for me, I think the most important thing would be that citizens, individual people in our countries, they would need to have very concrete experiences about democratic values. How does freedom and equality, like how do they feel? Like what is a concrete experience of equality, for example? Where can you experience that? And again, I come back to the dialogue, because I think in a dialogical conversation, you can have a really, really concrete experience of being included and being equal with the other people who are sitting there in the circle trying to talk together and understand things. So we need make lots of efforts to change how our democracies function, because I don't think they can survive all this crisis that we're having at the moment without this renewal.
Just this week was in Project Syndicate were published an article from former NATO General Secretary Rasmussen, where he wrote in this article that Europeans cannot preserve democracy and our way of life without soft power alone. We must dispense with the entrenched taboos and learn the language of hard power. That is only way to deter and defend against those who directly threaten our values and interests. Dialogue about hard power, its problem in European democracy, when we saw, for example, what happened in German government about help for Ukraine or pacifism as a value in European political culture, is a problem, especially what about Rasmussen is writing in this article.
This is interesting. I agree. I really think that we need to talk about the hard power at the moment. But it doesn't mean that we should completely kind of switch to talk just about the hard power. We need to find ways how the soft power, these values with that we want to, you know, because the hard power is there only for us to defend the soft ones, right? In that sort of sense. Without the soft ones, what is there to defend? Or the soft power, or the values. I don't want to call them soft values. I think they're hard values. In a way, they're strong values. And again, I think, I mean, I'm from Finland. We are one of the most militarized countries in Europe. But we are also one of the most stable democracies. And this is something that we have started to realize this in our country just after the attack, that suddenly we realized when the military threat becomes closer and there's a war in Europe that actually we are really militarized. We have a really big army. Our reserve is very big. We have, we have lots of bunkers all around in Finland. But that doesn't change the way that Finland functions.
And you have experience in winter war.
Yeah. But throughout that, all the decades that we were able to maintain this compromised independence and until the fall of the Soviet Union, we were building our society also to be military prepared. But at the same time, we wanted to have a welfare society. We wanted to have a democracy. And now we are in a situation, and I'm not saying Finland, obviously, it's not perfect. There are lots of issues that we need to deal with as well. But I think the combination of being one of the most militarized countries and being relatively stable, good democracy in many ways, that these can coexist. And we have a long tradition in that. So I think for me, it's a question that how can we strengthen the heart kind of a military defense part of our democracies without losing the core democratic values and the core commitment to peace. So it's not about pacifism as an ideology, it is a commitment to peace, but in this world situation we understand that in order to keep the peace, we need to be able to defend ourselves against threats that are out there. So, but there is a threat that this whole process of militarization kind of starts to take over and we will kind of start to lose the core values of our democracies because the militarization becomes so big.
But you also wrote in your book that the culture of negotiations is becoming more aggressive each year. Why is it now harder to deal with complex issues than before?
I think I wrote the culture of conversation in general, not just negotiations. Well, I think there are like three main reasons in my understanding. The first is the rise in inequality. There are so many people who feel really that they're left out from the society. They're struggling. They don't see a good future for themselves and their children. Then, obviously, there's the new technology, especially internet and the social media, that really feeds poison in our societies, and all with all the algorithms, especially in the social media, we know that they are very much feeding into those emotions that are strengthening affective polarizations like anxiety, fear, and anger. Those are the emotions that the algorithms kind of recognize and want to boost on because that keeps people engaged in social media. And I think the third, obviously, big crisis is the ecological crisis. And that affects us in many different ways. And I think it affects especially that part of the population who are quite young at the moment and they feel that they don't have a future on this planet. So all these are really, really complex issues. And all these processes also make us see those issues from a very, very different perspectives, and they involve lots of emotions. So those three elements, complex problems, very different points of view, and strong emotions, make talking about our common matters challenging. And again, that comes back to the question of, okay, if we want to solve those issues, work on those issues, we need dialogue. We need to understand the issues better, but we also need to understand each other better. How do we see them? Why do we see it differently? Why there is so much emotions involved in these topics?
You wrote in your book that communities are built and sustained through conversation. We live in rather fragmented informative space. How then can communication create here? Regulate social media? Is it possible in China? Is possible?
Well, I mean, my honest opinion is that we definitely should regulate social media immediately.
But how?
That's up to the European Union, I would assume, in that sort of case. But I think in general, there should be a change in the algorithms. We can't have these kind of platforms, including so many people, with algorithms that feed polarization. And those algorithms can be changed. And if the companies don't change them, then they should be, I don't know, what are the solutions? It's up to the governments to decide what they can do. But I think it creates a huge danger in our democracies at the moment. And we can see it in the United States, but it's obvious in many European countries also. But I think, okay, so that would be the kind of limiting part, but that won't be enough. I think what we need is that we need to create places for people to come together physically, face to face, have the opportunity to...
Besides this virtual culture.
Yeah, because we are animals, we are mammals. When we are here now in the same space, this is a bodily experience that is completely different if we would be having this discussion in Zoom. And we have actually quite a lot of neuroscientific data now how much our bodies communicate when we come to the same space. Our nervous systems are now regulating each other when we are in the same space. That happens with living beings. That happens with mammals. And that is one of the crucial things that helps us to understand each other and helps us to see each other as human beings, even though we have differences and we have difficulties. But because our societies are changing so rapidly through this technology, and almost everybody's carrying this small machine in their pocket that is feeding this poison to our social relationships, we need counter steps, we need counter measures. And I think one of the most important things is that we should actively create what I would call dialogical spaces in workplaces, in schools, in public services, in libraries, where people could really, again, come together physically, face-to-face, talk and understand, and then hopefully improve their abilities to do things together as well.
But regarding what we talked about Finland before and also Europe, what do you think, should Europe create its own counter-propaganda against Russian propaganda?
I don't think it would be a counter-propaganda, at least first. I think what should happen first is that Europe should... Because European Union was never created in a process which would have engaged a big part of the people living in these countries. It has always been a very bureaucratic process. Negotiations between governments and with people in the administration. And of course, it has created many, many good things. But at this moment, I think we should engage people, citizens, in a much wider basis to talk about what it means to be a European. Why is it important? What are the values? Why do we want to defend Europe? Why do we want to belong in the same family, like a family of nations? And it should be more imaginative. It could include the arts, not by creating propaganda by art, but like bringing out the experiences of different European people. It could engage the civil society in much more wider scale, because if the people who live inside European Union don't feel the relevance of that political entity, I don't think it can last. I mean, the far-right anti-European populistic parties are the biggest one, according to the polls at least, seem to be in Germany, in France. There's, Great United Kingdom is outside of European Union, but still part of Europe.
But you also have some movements in Finland. There.
Yeah. We have the far-right party in the government at the moment, but luckily we just have a regional and municipality elections, and they collapsed. Like a dramatic shift in their support was halved. So they used to be the third biggest party in the regional and municipality elections. Now they're in number six. So again, it seems that, you know, the tide can change. I don't know what's the reason behind it. I'm very happy about the result, but I think it's for me it tells that we can still do things, but we need to engage people much more.
But you, as an expert in dialogue, of course, when we're coming back to this Ukrainian question, how to negotiate peace after this kind of military conflict between Russians and Ukrainians? And what kind of dialogue do you think it's possible between Russians and Ukrainians after the war?
I assume it depends quite a lot, like what kind of peace there will be, like what is possible after the war.
Well, when you're thinking about this historical social memory of Finnish people after winter war.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you somehow need to find ways to get along with your neighbors. Like, that's what we keep saying in Finland. And it doesn't mean that you need to accept the way that they're doing things. I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult. I want to say one thing, which is crucial, is that we shouldn't have any illusions about the possibilities of dialogue. As long as it really looks like that Russia, the Russian leaders are not willing to do that in a genuine way. So then we just need to think about it through kind of to the questions of putting pressure and getting results from that aspect. But I think what I would hope that would happen more and more, I think we should really cherish the relationship with those Russian people who are against the Russian, you know, policy and the Russian war, and cherish and have dialogues with them, because through those dialogues there are the possibilities for any future, you know, coexistence with Russian people. And I think they have suffered so much, and it's quite understandable, but I think if we also start losing our connections with them, then that's a very bad situation. And in Finland, this is something that I've tried to do something about. I really try to include our Russian-speaking minority in our dialogue work. They have done wonderful work with dialogue. And obviously, I'm talking about especially these immigrants and these people who have fled Russia, who share the values, the democratic values. And they, and I think this is also important, they have the possibilities to try to reach out to those people who don't share those values and have some dialogue with them as well. So I can't probably do that, but some of them can. And I think
in between these people, sometimes this imperial mind is a problem between when we notice in this conversation on values that they're represented.
Yeah. I think there's obviously, I mean, according to the lots of research done in Finland also and polls, there's like a significant part of the Russian speaking minority in Finland they have this different mindset and they share different values. But again, if we want to understand how to deal with them, how to coexist with them, we need to have some sort of dialogue. And I think those Russian speaking people, I'm talking about Finland, but I think also in the Baltic countries, who want to be part of the European family and the European values, they are the key groups to reach out to those people also. And if for nothing else, then for security reasons, we need to know what's going on there in order to understand how should we deal with it.
Every time the World Happiness Index is announced and the Finns are on the top, we wonder how it's possible, because the same climate zone, half a year living in darkness, the same border with Russia, how does it work?
We are always surprised ourselves. But I, as our president emphasized, I agree with him on this issue that I think it has to do with societal trust. People are able to still trust each other and trust system
You mean political system?
The political system also. But it's not separate from the trust between the people, because in democracies we choose, you know, it's we know the people in the politics more or less. And we know the people who work in the government more or less. I mean, some, you know, it's not like they're not a separate elite. I don't think they are in Latvia either. They are, you know, people amongst us. So the general trust is an important thing. And I also think that somehow in Finland, we still think that even though times are tough, we can solve things together. I mean, there is polarization going on and it's not getting better that much. But I think there's still lots of faith in the idea that we can solve things together. And of course, that is based on the issue of trust. But trust is not something that just, you know, exists or you can take for granted. You need to work, you know, constantly to improve trust in different parts of the society. It's happening in our daily encounters, like how do I react to people on the streets? How do I talk with the teacher of my children or with the nurse in the hospital that I go to? And so we need to keep it going.
But how to build up this system of trust? It's like a sort of political culture which could be changed not in 1 year, not in 2 years. And when we look at the Latvia, for example, I would say also not only in 30 years.
But you have done amazing things here. I mean, I'm always, when I come to Latvia, I admire your achievement so much, like what you have managed to do in 30 years. For me, it looks like I can't believe this is possible, like only within 30 years you're here. And I think you have great things going on here. I mean, building trust is not easy, but I think that it is still happening here. I'm a big admirer of the Lampa Conversation Festival. That's how I started to come here to Latvia. And I think that's one of the most concrete examples that you can really make an effort to do things that build trust.
Yeah, but it's also some bubble.
Yeah, it is a bubble. But I think that, like, the bubble thing is not... Bubbles can become bigger. Bubbles can become more inclusive. Bubbles can become more dialogical. And if there's dialogue inside the bubble a lot, I think there will be more dialogues also between the bubbles. So there are lots of ways that we can build trust in our societies. We just have to start working on it. In many cases, it needs to be a deliberate attempt. We just can't, you know, sit there and think, you know, it's not going to happen. You know, it's not possible. If we think like that, it definitely is not going to happen. So I think, and I see, I mean, of course, whenever I come to Latvia, and I come here quite often, many times a year, I always see incredibly interesting things happening to strengthen your democratic society. Of course, those are the people that I'm involved with here, but I really do see things happening, and I really admire, and I learn a lot from my Latvian colleagues all the time.
Thank you. Tas bija Kais Alhanens, Somu politikas filozofs. Mans vārds Gīns Grūbe, raidījumu ierakstīja Toms Šits un Montaja Nora. Mīts, paldies. Thank you.
Thank you.